Oliver Twist, Chapters 10 through 12.
Chapter 10. Oliver becomes better acquainted with the characters of his new associates and purchases experience at a high price, being a short but very important chapter in this history. For many days, Oliver remained in the Jew's room, picking the marks out of the pocket handkerchief, of which a great number were brought home, and sometimes taking part in the game already described, which the two boys and the Jew played regularly every morning. At length, he began to languish for fresh air, and took many occasions of earnestly entreating the old gentleman to allow him to go out to work with his two companions. Oliver was rendered the more anxious to be actively employed by what he had seen of the stern morality of the old man's character. Whenever the Dodger or Charlie Bates came home at night empty-handed, he would expatiate with great vehemence on the misery of idle and lazy habits, and would enforce upon them the necessity of an active life by sending them supperless to bed. On one occasion, indeed, he even went so far as to knock them both down a flight of stairs, but this was carrying out his virtuous precepts to an unusual extent. At length one morning, Oliver obtained the permission he had so eagerly sought. There had been no handkerchiefs to work upon for 2 or 3 days, and the dinners had been rather meagre. Perhaps these were reasons for the old gentleman's giving his assent, but whether they were or no, he told Oliver he might go, and placed him under the joint guardianship of Charlie Bates and his friend the Dodger. The three boys sallied out, the Dodger with his coat sleeves tucked up and his hat cocked as usual, Master Bates sauntering along with his hands in his pockets, and Oliver between them, wondering where they were going and what branch of manufacture he would be instructed in first. The pace at which they went was such a very lazy, ill-looking saunter that Oliver soon began to think his companions were going to deceive the old man by not going to work at all. The Dodger had a vicious propensity, too, of pulling the caps from the heads of small boys and tossing them down areas, while Charlie Bates exhibited some very loose notions concerning the rights of property by pilfering divers apples and onions from the stalls at the kennel sides and thrusting them into pockets which were so surprisingly capacious that they seemed to undermine his whole suit of clothes in every direction. These things looked so bad that Oliver was on the point of declaring his intention of seeking his way back in the best way he could, when his thoughts were suddenly directed into another channel by a very mysterious change of behavior on the part of the Dodger. They were just emerging from a narrow court not far from the open square in Clerkenwell, which is yet, by some strange perversion of terms, called the Green, when the Dodger made a sudden stop, and laying his finger on his lips, drew his companions back again with the greatest caution and circumspection. "What's the matter?" demanded Oliver. "Hush!" replied the Dodger. "Do you see that old cove at the bookstall?"
"The old gentleman over the way?" said Oliver. "Yes, I see him."
"He'll do," said the Dodger.
"A prime plant," observed Master Charlie Bates.
Oliver looked from one to the other with the greatest surprise, but he was not permitted to make any inquiries, for the two boys walked stealthily across the road and slunk close behind the old gentleman towards whom his attention had been directed. Oliver walked a few paces after them, and, not knowing whether to advance or retire, stood looking on in silent amazement. The old gentleman was a very respectable-looking personage, with a powdered head and gold spectacles. He was dressed in a bottle-green coat with a black velvet collar, wore white trousers, and carried a smart bamboo cane under his arm. He had taken up a book from the stall, and there he stood reading away as hard as if he were in his elbow chair in his own study. It was very possible that he fancied himself there indeed, for it was plain from his abstraction that he saw not the bookstall, nor the street, nor the boys, nor, in short, anything but the book itself, which he was reading straight through, turning over the leaf when he got to the bottom of a page, beginning at the top line of the next one, and going regularly on with the greatest interest and eagerness.
What was Oliver's horror and alarm as he stood a few paces off, looking on with his eyelids as wide open as they would possibly go, to see the Dodger plunge his hand into the old gentleman's pocket and draw from thence a handkerchief, to see him hand the same to Charlie Bates, and finally to behold them running away around the corner at full speed. In an instant, the whole mystery of the handkerchiefs and the watches and the jewels and the Jew rushed upon the boy's mind. He stood for a moment with the blood so tingling through his veins from terror that he felt as if he were in a burning fire. Then, confused and frightened, he took to his heels, and not knowing what he did, made off as fast as he could lay his feet to the ground. This was all done in a minute's space. In the very instant when Oliver began to run, the old gentleman, putting his hand to his pocket and missing his handkerchief, turned sharp round. Seeing the boy scudding away at such a rapid pace, he very naturally concluded him to be the depredator, and shouting, "Stop, thief!" with all his might, made off after him, book in hand. But the old gentleman was not the only person who raised the hue and cry. The Dodger and Master Bates, unwilling to attract public attention by running down the open street, had merely retired into the very first doorway round the corner. They no sooner heard the cry and saw Oliver running than, guessing exactly how the matter stood, they issued forth with great promptitude, and shouting, "Stop, thief!" too, joined in the pursuit, like good citizens. Although Oliver had been brought up by philosophers, he was not theoretically acquainted with the beautiful axiom that self-preservation is the first law of nature. If he had been, perhaps he would have been prepared for this. Not being prepared, however, it alarmed him the more. So away he went like the wind, with the old gentleman and the two boys roaring and shouting behind him, "Stop, thief! Stop, thief!" There is a magic in the sound. The tradesman leaves his counter, and the carman his wagon. The butcher throws down his tray, the baker his basket, the milkman his pail, the errand boy his parcels, the schoolboy his marbles, the pavior his pickaxe, the child his battledore. Away they run, pell-mell, helter-skelter, slap-dash, tearing, yelling, screaming, knocking down the passengers as they turn the corners, rousing up the dogs and astonishing the fowls, and streets, squares, and courts re-echo with the sound. "Stop, thief! Stop, thief!" The cry is taken up by 100 voices, and the crowd accumulate at every turning. Away they fly, splashing through the mud and rattling along the pavements. Up go the windows, out run the people, onward bear the mob. A whole audience desert Punch in the very thickest of the plot, and joining the rushing throng, swell the shout and lend fresh vigor to the cry, "Stop, thief! Stop, thief!" Stop, thief! Stop, thief! There is a passion for hunting something deeply implanted in the human breast. One wretched, breathless child, panting with exhaustion, terror in his looks, agony in his eyes, large drops of perspiration streaming down his face, strains every nerve to make head upon his pursuers, and as they follow on his track and gain upon him every instant, they hail his decreasing strength with joy. "Stop, thief!" Aye, stop him for God's sake, were it only in mercy. Stopped at last. A clever blow. He is down upon the pavement, and the crowd eagerly gather around him, each newcomer jostling and struggling with the others to catch a glimpse. "Stand aside! Give him a little air! Nonsense, he don't deserve it! Where's the gentleman? Here he is, coming down the street! Make room for the gentleman! Is this the boy, sir?" "Yes." Oliver lay, covered with mud and dust, bleeding from the mouth, looking wildly round upon the heap of faces that surrounded him, when the old gentleman was officiously dragged and pushed into the circle by the foremost of the pursuers. "Yes," said the gentleman, "I am afraid it is the boy." "Afraid?" murmured the crowd. "That's a good'un." "Poor fellow!
said the gentleman. "He has hurt himself."
"I did that, sir," said a great lubberly fellow, stepping forward. "And preciously I cut my knuckle agin his mouth. I stopped him, sir."
The fellow touched his hat with a grin, expecting something for his pains, but the old gentleman, eyeing him with an expression of dislike, looked anxiously around, as if he contemplated running away himself, which it is very possible he might have attempted to do, and thus have afforded another chase, had not a police officer, who is generally the last person to arrive in such cases, at that moment made his way through the crowd and seized Oliver by the collar.
"Come, get up," said the man roughly.
"It wasn't me, indeed, sir. Indeed, indeed, it was two other boys," said Oliver, clasping his hands passionately and looking around. "They are here, somewhere."
"Oh, no, they ain't," said the officer.
He meant this to be ironical, but it was true besides, for the Dodger and Charlie Bates had filed off down the first convenient court they came to.
"Come, get up!"
"Don't hurt him," said the old gentleman compassionately.
"Oh, no, I won't hurt him," replied the officer, tearing his jacket half off his back in proof thereof. "Come, I know you. It won't do. Will you stand upon your legs, you young devil?"
Oliver, who could barely stand, made a shift to raise himself on his feet and was at once lugged along the streets by the jacket collar at a rapid pace. The gentleman walked on with them by the officer's side, and as many of the crowd as could achieve the feat got a little ahead and stared back at Oliver from time to time. The boys shouted in triumph, and on they went.
Chapter 11. Treats of Mr. Fang, the police magistrate, and furnishes a slight specimen of his mode of administering justice. The offense had been committed within the district, and indeed in the immediate neighborhood of a very notorious metropolitan police office. The crowd had only the satisfaction of accompanying Oliver through two or three streets and down a place called Mutton Hill, when he was led beneath a low archway and up a dirty court into this dispensary of summary justice by the back way. It was a small paved yard into which they turned, and here they encountered a stout man with a bunch of whiskers on his face and a bunch of keys in his hand. "What's the matter now?" said the man carelessly. "A young fogle hunter," replied the man who had Oliver in charge. "Are you the party that's been robbed, sir?" inquired the man with the keys. "Yes, I am," replied the old gentleman. "But I am not sure that this boy actually took the handkerchief. I would rather not press the case." "Must go before the magistrate now, sir," replied the man. "His worship will be disengaged in half a minute. Now, young gallows!" This was an invitation for Oliver to enter through a door which he unlocked as he spoke, and which led into a stone cell. Here he was searched, and nothing being found upon him, locked up. This cell was in shape and size something like an area cellar, only not so light. It was most intolerably dirty, for it was Monday morning, and it had been tenanted by six drunken people who had been locked up elsewhere since Saturday night. But this is little. In our station houses, men and women are every night confined on the most trivial charges. The word is worth noting, in dungeons, compared with which those in Newgate, occupied by the most atrocious felons, tried, found guilty, and under sentence of death are palaces. Let anyone who doubts this compare the two. The old gentleman looked almost as rueful as Oliver when the key grated in the lock. He turned with a sigh to the book which had been the innocent cause of all this disturbance. "There is something in that boy's face," said the old gentleman to himself as he walked slowly away, tapping his chin with the cover of the book in a thoughtful manner. "Something that touches and interests me. Can he be innocent? He looked like... By the by," exclaimed the old gentleman, halting very abruptly and staring up into the sky. "Bless my soul, where have I seen something like that before?" After musing for some minutes, the old gentleman walked with the same meditative face into a back anteroom opening from the yard, and there, retiring into a corner, called up before his mind's eye a vast amphitheater of faces over which a dusky curtain had hung for many years. "No," said the old gentleman, shaking his head. "It must be imagination." He wandered over them again. He had called them into view, and it was not easy to replace the shroud that had so long concealed them. There were the faces of friends and foes, and of many that had been almost strangers peering intrusively from the crowd. There were the faces of young and blooming girls that were now old women. There were faces that the grave had changed and closed upon, but which the mind, superior to its power, still dressed in their old freshness and beauty, calling back the luster of the eyes, the brightness of the smile, the beaming of the soul through its mask of clay, and whispering of beauty beyond the tomb, changed but to be heightened, and taken from earth only to be set up as a light, to send a soft and gentle glow upon the path to heaven. But the old gentleman could recall no one countenance of which Oliver's features bore a trace. So he heaved a sigh over the recollections he awakened, and being, happily for himself, an absent old gentleman, buried them again in the pages of the musty book. He was roused by a touch on the shoulder and a request from the man with the keys to follow him into the office. He closed his book hastily and was at once ushered into the imposing presence of the renowned Mr. Fang. The office was a front parlor with a paneled wall. Mr. Fang sat behind a bar at the upper end, and on one side the door was a sort of wooden pen in which poor little Oliver was already deposited, trembling very much at the awfulness of the scene. Mr. Fang was a lean, long-backed, stiff-necked, middle-sized man with no great quantity of hair, and what he had growing on the back and sides of his head. His face was stern and much flushed. If he were really not in the habit of drinking rather more than was exactly good for him, he might have brought action against his countenance for libel and have recovered heavy damages. The old gentleman bowed respectfully, and advancing to the magistrate's desk, said, suiting the action to the word, "That is my name and address, sir." He then withdrew a pace or two, and with another polite and gentlemanly inclination of the head, waited to be questioned. Now, it so happened that Mr. Fang was at that moment perusing a leading article in the newspaper of the morning, adverting to some recent decision of his, and commending him for the 350th time to the special and particular notice of the Secretary of State for the Home Department. He was out of temper, and he looked up with an angry scowl. "Who are you?" said Mr. Fang. The old gentleman pointed with some surprise to his card. "Officer," said Mr. Fang, tossing the card contemptuously away with the newspaper. "Who is this fellow?" "My name, sir," said the old gentleman, speaking like a gentleman, "my name, sir, is Brownlow. Permit me to inquire the name of the magistrate who offers a gratuitous and unprovoked insult to a respectable person under the protection of the bench." Saying this, Mr. Brownlow looked around the office as if in search of some person who would afford him the required information. "Officer," said Mr. Fang, throwing the paper on one side, "what's this fellow charged with?" "He's not charged at all, your worship," replied the officer. "He appears against this boy, your worship." His worship knew this perfectly well, but it was a good annoyance and a safe one. "Appears against the boy, does he?" said Mr. Fang, surveying Mr. Brownlow contemptuously from head to foot. "Swear him." "Before I am sworn, I must beg to say one word," said Mr. Brownlow, "and that is that I really never, without actual experience, could have believed..." "Hold your tongue," said Mr. Fang peremptorily. "I will not," replied the old gentleman. "Hold your tongue this instant, or I'll have you turned out of the office," said Mr. Fang. "You're an insolent, impertinent fellow. How dare you bully a magistrate? What? Exclaimed the old gentleman, reddening. Swear this person, said Fang to the clerk. I'll not hear another word. Swear him. Mr. Brownlow's indignation was greatly roused, but reflecting perhaps that he might only injure the boy by giving vent to it, he suppressed his feelings and submitted to be sworn at once. Now, said Fang, what's the charge against this boy? What have you got to say, sir? I was standing at a bookstall, Mr. Brownlow began. Hold your tongue, sir, said Mr. Fang. Policeman? Where's a policeman? Here, swear this policeman. Now, policeman, what is this? The policeman, with becoming humility, related how he had taken the charge, how he had searched Oliver and found nothing on his person, and how that was all he knew about it. Are there any witnesses? Inquired Mr. Fang. None, your worship, replied the policeman. Mr. Fang sat silent for some minutes, and then, turning round to the prosecutor, said in a towering passion, Do you mean to state what your complaint against this boy is, man, or do you not? You have been sworn. Now, if you stand there, refusing to give evidence, I'll punish you for disrespect to the bench. I will by what? Or by whom, nobody knows, for the clerk and jailer coughed very loud just at the right moment, and the former dropped a heavy book upon the floor, thus preventing the word from being heard. Accidentally, of course. With many interruptions and repeated insults, Mr. Brownlow contrived to state his case, observing that, in the surprise of the moment, he had run after the boy because he had saw him running away, and expressing his hope that, if the magistrate should believe him, although not actually the thief, to be connected with the thieves, he would deal as leniently with him as justice would allow. He has been hurt already, said the old gentleman in conclusion. And I fear, he added with great energy, looking towards the bar, I really fear that he is ill. Oh, yes, I dare say, said Mr. Fang with a sneer. Come! None of your tricks here, you young vagabond. They won't do. What's your name? Oliver tried to reply, but his tongue failed him. He was deadly pale, and the whole place seemed turning round and round. What's your name, you hardened scoundrel? Demanded Mr. Fang. Officer, what's his name? This was addressed to a bluff old fellow in a striped waistcoat who was standing by the bar. He bent over Oliver and repeated the inquiry, but finding him really incapable of understanding the question, and knowing that his not replying would only infuriate the magistrate the more, and add to the severity of his sentence, he hazarded a guess. He says his name's Tom White, your worship, said the kind-hearted thief-taker. Oh, he won't speak out, won't he? Said Fang. Very well, very well. Where does he live? Where he can, your worship, replied the officer, again pretending to receive Oliver's answer. Has he any parents? Inquired Mr. Fang. He says they died in his infancy, your worship, replied the officer, hazarding the usual reply. At this point of the inquiry, Oliver raised his head and, looking round with imploring eyes, murmured a feeble prayer for a draught of water. Stuff and nonsense! Said Mr. Fang. Don't try to make a fool of me. I think he really is ill, your worship, remonstrated the officer. I know better, said Mr. Fang. Take care of him, officer, said the old gentleman, raising his hands instinctively. He'll fall down. Stand away, officer, cried Fang. Let him if he likes. Oliver availed himself of the kind permission and fell to the floor in a fainting fit. The men in the office looked at each other, but no one dared to stir. I knew he was shamming, said Fang, as if this were incontestable proof of the fact. Let him lie there. He'll soon be tired of that. How do you propose to deal with the case, sir? Inquired the clerk in a low voice. Summarily, replied Mr. Fang. He stands committed for 3 months, Hard labor, of course. Clear the office. The door was opened for this purpose, and a couple of men were preparing to carry the insensible boy to his cell, when an elderly man of decent but poor appearance, clad in an old suit of black, rushed hastily into the office and advanced towards the bench. "Stop! Stop! Don't take him away! For heaven's sake, stop a moment!" cried the newcomer, breathless with haste. Although the presiding genie in such an office as this exercise a summary and arbitrary power over the liberties, the good name, the character, almost the lives of Her Majesty's subjects, especially of the poorer class, and although within such walls enough fantastic tricks are daily played to make the angels blind with weeping, they are closed to the public, save through the medium of the daily press. Footnote, or were virtually then. Mr. Fang was consequently not a little indignant to see an unbidden guest enter in such irreverent disorder. "What is this? Who is this? Turn this man out! Clear the office!" cried Mr. Fang. "I will speak," cried the man. "I will not be turned out. I saw it all. I keep the bookstall. I demand to be sworn. I will not be put down, Mr. Fang. You must hear me. You must not refuse, sir." The man was right. His manner was determined, and the matter was growing rather too serious to be hushed up. "Swear to man," growled Mr. Fang with a very ill grace. "Now, man, what have you got to say?" "This," said the man. "I saw three boys, two others, and the prisoner here, loitering on the opposite side of the way when this gentleman was reading. The robbery was committed by another boy. I saw it done, and I saw that this boy was perfectly amazed and stupefied by it." Having by this time recovered a little breath, the worthy bookstall keeper proceeded to relate, in a more coherent manner, the exact circumstances of the robbery. "Why didn't you come here before?" said Fang after a pause. "I hadn't a soul to mind the shop," replied the man. "Everybody who could have helped me had joined in the pursuit. I could get nobody till 5 minutes ago, and I've run here all the way." "The prosecutor was reading, was he?" inquired Fang after another pause. "Yes," replied the man. "The very book he has in his hand."
"Ah, that book, eh?"
said Fang.
"Is it paid for?"
"No, it is not," replied the man with a smile. "Dear me, I forgot all about it," exclaimed the absent old gentleman innocently.
"A nice person to prefer a charge against a poor boy," said Fang with a comical effort to look humane. "I consider, sir, that you have obtained possession of that book under very suspicious and disreputable circumstances, and you may think yourself very fortunate that the owner of the property declines to prosecute. Let this be a lesson to you, my man, or the law will overtake you yet. The boy is discharged. Clear the office."
"Damn me," cried the old gentleman, bursting out the rage he had kept down so long. "Damn me!
Clear the office," said the magistrate. "Officers, do you hear? Clear the office."
The mandate was obeyed, and the indignant Mr. Brownlow was conveyed out, with the book in one hand and the bamboo cane in the other, in a perfect frenzy of rage and defiance. He reached the yard, and his passion vanished in a moment. Little Oliver Twist lay on his back on the pavement, with his shirt unbuttoned and his temples bathed with water, his face a deadly white, and a cold tremble convulsing his whole frame. "Poor boy, poor boy," said Mr. Brownlow, bending over him.
"Call a coach. Somebody pray. Directly."
A coach was obtained, and Oliver, having been carefully laid on a seat, the old gentleman got in and sat himself on the other. "May I accompany you?" said the bookstall keeper, looking in.
"Bless me. Yes, my dear sir," said Mr. Brownlow quickly.
"I forgot you.
Dear, dear. I have this unhappy book still. Jump in, poor fellow. There's no time to lose."
The bookstall keeper got into the coach, and away they drove.
Chapter 12. in which Oliver is taken better care of than he ever was before, and in which the narrative reverts to the merry old gentleman and his youthful friends. The coach rattled away over nearly the same ground as that which Oliver had traversed when he first entered London in company with the Dodger, and turning a different way when it reached the Angel of Islington, stopped at length before a neat house in a quiet, shady street near Pentonville. Here a bed was prepared, without loss of time, in which Mr. Brownlow saw his young charge carefully and comfortably deposited. And here he was tended with a kindness and solicitude that knew no bounds. But for many days, Oliver remained insensible to all the goodness of his new friends. The sun rose and sank, and rose and sank again, and many times after that, and still the boy lay stretched on his uneasy bed, dwindling away beneath the dry and wasting heat of fever. The worm does not work more surely on the dead body than does the slow creeping fire upon the living frame. Weak and thin and pallid, he awoke at last from what seemed to have been a long and troubled dream. Feebly raising himself in the bed, with his head resting on his trembling arm, he looked anxiously around. "What room is this? Where have I been brought to?" said Oliver. "This is not the place I went to sleep in." He uttered these words in a feeble voice, being very faint and weak, but they were overheard at once. The curtain at the bed's head was hastily drawn back, and a motherly old lady, very neatly and precisely dressed, rose as she undrew it from an armchair close by, in which she had been sitting at needlework. "Hush, my dear," said the old lady softly. "You must be very quiet, or you will be ill again, and you have been very bad as bad could be, pretty nigh. Lie down again, there's a dear." With those words, the old lady very gently placed Oliver's head upon the pillow, and smoothing back his hair from his forehead, looked so kindly and loving in his face that he could not help placing his little withered hand in hers and drawing it round his neck. "Save us," said the old lady, with tears in her eyes. "What a grateful little dear it is! Pretty creature! What would his mother feel if she had sat by him as I have and could see him now?" "Perhaps she does see me," whispered Oliver, folding his hands together. "Perhaps she has sat by me. I almost feel as if she had." "That was the fever, my dear," said the old lady mildly. "I suppose it was," replied Oliver, "because heaven is a long way off, and they are too happy there to come down to the bedside of a poor boy. But if she knew I was ill, she must have pitied me even there, for she was very ill herself before she died. She can't know anything about me, though," added Oliver after a moment's silence. "If she had seen me hurt, it would have made her sorrowful, and her face has always looked very sweet and happy when I have dreamed of her." The old lady made no reply to this, but wiping her eyes first, and her spectacles, which lay on the counterpane afterwards, as if they were part and parcel of those features, brought some cool stuff for Oliver to drink, and then patting him on the cheek, told him he must lie very quiet or he would be ill again. So Oliver kept very still, partly because he was anxious to obey the kind old lady in all things, and partly to tell the truth, because he was completely exhausted with what he had already said. He soon fell into a gentle doze, from which he was awakened by the light of a candle, which, being brought near the bed, showed him a gentleman with a very large and loud-ticking gold watch in his hand, who felt his pulse, and said he was a great deal better. "You are a great deal better, are you not, my dear?" said the gentleman. "Yes, thank you, sir," replied Oliver. "Yes, I know you are," said the gentleman. "You're hungry, too, ain't you?" "No, sir," answered Oliver. "Ahem," said the gentleman. "No, I know you're not." "He is not hungry, Mrs. Bedwin," said the gentleman, looking very wise. The old lady made a respectful inclination of the head, which seemed to say that she thought the doctor was a very clever man. The doctor appeared much of the same opinion himself. "You feel sleepy, don't you, my dear?" said the doctor. "No, sir," replied Oliver. "No," said the doctor, with a very shrewd and satisfied look. "You're not sleepy, nor thirsty, are you?" "Yes, sir, rather thirsty," answered Oliver. "Just as I expected, Mrs. Bedwin," said the doctor. "It's very natural that he should be thirsty. You may give him a little tea, ma'am, and some dry toast without butter. Don't keep him too warm, ma'am, but be careful that you don't let him be too cold. Will you have the goodness?" The old lady dropped a curtsy. The doctor, after tasting the cool stuff and expressing a qualified approval of it, hurried away, his boots creaking in a very important and wealthy manner as he went downstairs. Oliver dozed off again. Soon after this, when he awoke, it was nearly 12 o'clock. The old lady tenderly bade him good night shortly afterwards, and left him in charge of a fat old lady who had just come, bringing with her, in a little bundle, a small prayer book and a large nightcap. Putting the latter on her head and the former on the table, the old woman, after telling Oliver that she had come to sit up with him, drew her chair close to the fire and went off into a series of short naps, checkered at frequent intervals, with sundry tumblings forward and divers moans and chokings. These, however, had no worse effect than causing her to rub her nose very hard and then fall asleep again. And thus the night crept slowly on. Oliver lay awake for some time, counting the little circles of light which the reflection of the rushlight shade threw upon the ceiling, or tracing with his languid eyes the intricate pattern of the paper on the wall. The darkness and the deep stillness of the room were very solemn, as they brought into the boy's mind the thought that death had been hovering there for many days and nights, and might yet fill it with the gloom and dread of his awful presence. He turned his face upon the pillow and fervently prayed to heaven. Gradually he fell into that deep, tranquil sleep which ease from recent suffering alone imparts, that calm and peaceful rest which it is pain to wake from. Who, if this were death, would be roused again to all the struggles and turmoils of life, to all its cares for the present, its anxieties for the future, more than all, its weary recollections of the past? It had been bright day for hours when Oliver opened his eyes. He felt cheerful and happy. The crisis of the disease was safely past. He belonged to the world again. In 3 days' time, he was able to sit in an easy chair, well propped up with pillows, and, as he was still too weak to walk, Mrs. Bedwin had him carried downstairs into the little housekeeper's room, which belonged to her. Having him set here by the fireside, the good old lady sat herself down too, and, being in a state of considerable delight at seeing him so much better, forthwith began to cry most violently. "Never mind me, my dear," said the old lady. "I'm only having a regular good cry. There, it's all over now, and I'm quite comfortable." "You're very, very kind to me, ma'am," said Oliver. "Well, never you mind that, my dear," said the old lady. "That's got nothing to do with your broth, and it's full time you had it, for the doctor says Mr. Brownlow may come in to see you this morning, and we must get up our best looks, because the better we look, the more he'll be pleased." And with this, the old lady applied herself to warming up in a little saucepan, a basin full of broth strong enough, Oliver thought, to furnish an ample dinner when reduced to the regulation strength for 350 paupers at the lowest computation. "Are you fond of pictures, dear?" inquired the old lady, seeing that Oliver had fixed his eyes most intently on a portrait which hung against the wall just opposite the chair. "I don't quite know, ma'am," said Oliver, without taking his eyes from the canvas. "I have seen so few that I hardly know. What a beautiful, mild face that lady is." "Ah," said the old lady, "painters always make ladies out prettier than they are, or they wouldn't get any custom, child. The man that invented the machine for taking likenesses might have known that would never succeed. It's a deal too honest." "A deal," said the old lady, laughing very heartily at her own acuteness. Is that a likeness, ma'am?" said Oliver. Yes, said the old lady, looking up for a moment from the broth. That's a portrait. Whose, ma'am? Asked Oliver. Why, really, my dear, I don't know, answered the old lady in a good-humored manner. It's not a likeness of anybody that you or I know, I expect. It seems to strike your fancy, dear. It's so pretty, replied Oliver. Why, sure you're not afraid of it? Said the old lady, observing in a great surprise the look of awe with which the child regarded the painting. Oh, no, no, returned Oliver quickly. But the eyes look so sorrowful, and where I sit, they seem fixed upon me. It makes my heart beat, added Oliver in a lower voice, as if it was alive and wanted to speak to me, but couldn't. Lord save us, exclaimed the old lady, starting. Don't talk in that way, child. You're weak and nervous after your illness. Let me wheel your chair round to the other side, and then you won't see it. There, said the old lady, suiting the action to the word. You don't see it now, at all events. Oliver did see it in the mind's eye as distinctly as if he had not altered his position. But he thought it better not to worry the kind old lady. So he smiled gently when she looked at him, and Mrs. Bedwin, satisfied that he felt more comfortable, salted and broke bits of toasted bread into the broth, with all the bustle befitting so solemn a preparation. Oliver got through it with extraordinary expedition. He had scarcely swallowed the last spoonful when there came a soft rap at the door. Come in, said the old lady, and in walked Mr. Brownlow. Now the old gentleman came in as brisk as need be, but he had no sooner raised his spectacles on his forehead and thrust his hands behind the skirts of his dressing gown to take a good look at Oliver than in his countenance underwent a very great variety of old contortions. Oliver looked very worn and shadowy from sickness and made an ineffectual attempt to stand up, out of respect to his benefactor, which terminated in his sinking back into the chair again. And the fact is, if the truth must be told, that Mr. Brownlow's heart, being large enough for any six ordinary old gentlemen of humane disposition, forced a supply of tears into his eyes. By some hydraulic process, which we are not sufficiently philosophical to be in a condition to explain. Poor boy, poor boy, said Mr. Brownlow, clearing his throat. I'm rather hoarse this morning, Mrs. Bedwin. I'm afraid I've caught cold. I hope not, sir, said Mrs. Bedwin. Everything you have had has been well aired, sir. I don't know, said Mr. Brownlow. I rather think I had a damp napkin at dinner time yesterday. But never mind that. How do you feel, my dear? Very happy, sir, replied Oliver, and very grateful indeed, sir, for your goodness to me. Goodbye, said Mr. Brownlow stoutly. Have you given him any nourishment, Bedwin? Any slops, eh? He has just had a basin of beautiful strong broth, sir, replied Mrs. Bedwin, drawing herself up slightly and laying strong emphasis on the last word, to intimate that between slops and broth well compounded there existed no affinity or connection whatsoever. Ugh, said Mr. Brownlow, with a slight shudder. A couple of glasses of port wine would have done him a great deal more good, wouldn't they, Tom White, eh? My name is Oliver, sir, replied the little invalid, with a look of great astonishment. Oliver, said Mr. Brownlow. Oliver what? Oliver White, eh? No, sir, Twist, Oliver Twist. Queer name, said the old gentleman. What made you tell the magistrate your name was White? I never told him so, sir, returned Oliver in amazement. This sounded so like a falsehood that the old gentleman looked somewhat sternly in Oliver's face. It was impossible to doubt him. There is truth in every one of its thin and sharpened lineaments. Some mistake, said Mr. Brownlow. But, although his motive for looking steadily at Oliver no longer existed, the old idea of the resemblance between his features and some familiar face came upon him so strongly that he could not withdraw his gaze. I hope you are not angry with me, sir, said Oliver, raising his eyes beseechingly. No, no, replied the old gentleman. Why, what's this, Bedwin? Look there. As he spoke, he pointed hastily to the picture over Oliver's head, and then to the boy's face. There was its living copy. The eyes, the head, the mouth, every feature was the same. The expression was, for the instant, so precisely alike that the minutest line seemed copied with startling accuracy. Oliver knew not the cause of this sudden exclamation, for, not being strong enough to bear the start it gave him, he fainted away. A weakness on his part, which affords the narrative an opportunity of relieving the reader from suspense, in behalf of the two young pupils of the merry old gentleman and of recording, that when the Dodger and his accomplished friend Master Bates joined in at the hue and cry, which was raised at Oliver's heels, in consequence of their executing an illegal conveyance of Mr. Brownlow's personal property, as it has been already described, they were actuated by a very laudable and becoming regard for themselves, and forasmuch as the freedom of the subject and liberty of the individual are among the first and proudest boasts of a true-hearted Englishman, so I need hardly beg the reader to observe that this action should tend to exalt them in the opinion of all public and patriotic men, in almost as great a degree as the strong proof of their anxiety for their own preservation and safety goes to corroborate and confirm the little code of laws which certain profound and sound-judging philosophers have laid down as the mainsprings of all nature's deeds and actions, the said philosophers very wisely reducing the good lady's proceedings to matters of maxim and theory, and by a very neat and pretty compliment to her exalted wisdom and understanding, putting entirely out of sight any considerations of heart, or generous impulse and feeling. For these are matters totally beneath a female who is acknowledged by universal admission to be far above the numerous little foibles and weaknesses of her sex. If I wanted any further proof of the strictly philosophical nature of the conduct of these young gentlemen and their very delicate predicament, I should at once find it in the fact, also recorded in a foregoing part of this narrative, of their quitting the pursuit when the general attention was fixed upon Oliver, and making immediately for their home by the shortest possible cut. Although I do not mean to assert that it is usually the practice of renowned and learned sages to shorten the road to any great conclusion, their course indeed being rather to lengthen the distance by various circumlocutions and discursive staggerings, like unto those in which drunken men, under the pressure of a too mighty flow of ideas, are prone to indulge. Still, I do mean to say, and do say distinctly, that it is the invariable practice of many mighty philosophers in carrying out their theories to evince great wisdom and foresight in providing against every possible contingency which can be supposed at all likely to affect themselves. Thus, to do a great right, you may do a little wrong, and you may take any means which the end to be attained will justify, the amount of the right or the amount of the wrong, or indeed the distinction between the two, being left entirely to the philosopher concerned, to be settled and determined by his clear, comprehensive, and impartial view of his own particular case. It was not until the two boys had scoured, with great rapidity, through a most intricate maze of narrow streets and courts, that they ventured to halt beneath a low and dark archway. Having remained silent here, just long enough to recover breath to speak, Master Bates uttered an exclamation of amusement and delight, and, bursting into an uncontrollable fit of laughter, flung himself upon a doorstep and rolled thereon in a transport of mirth. "What's the matter?" inquired the Dodger. "Ha, ha, ha!" roared Charlie Bates. "Hold your noise," remonstrated the Dodger, looking cautiously round. "Do you want to be grabbed, stupid?" "I can't help it," said Charlie. "I can't help it. To see him splitting away at that pace and cutting round the corners and knocking up again the post and starting on again as if he was made of iron as well as them, and me with the wipe in my pocket singing out arter him. Oh, my eye!" The vivid imagination of Mr. Bates presented the scene before him in two strong colors. As he arrived at this apostrophe, he again rolled upon the doorstep and laughed louder than before. "What'll Fagin say?" inquired the Dodger, taking advantage of the next interval of breathlessness on the part of his friend to propound the question. "What?" repeated Charlie Bates. "What?" said the Dodger. "Why, what should he say?" inquired Charlie, stopping rather suddenly in his merriment, for the Dodger's manner was impressive. "What should he say?" Mr. Dawkins whistled for a couple of minutes, then, taking off his hat, scratched his head and nodded thrice. "What do you mean?" said Charlie. "Tarululu, gammon and spinach, the frog he wouldn't, and high cockalorum," said the Dodger, with a slight sneer on his intellectual countenance. That was explanatory, but not satisfactory. Master Bates felt it so, and again said, "What do you mean?" The Dodger made no reply, but putting his hat on again, and gathering the skirts of his long-tailed coat under his arm, thrust his tongue into his cheek, slapped the bridge of his nose some half-dozen times in a familiar but expressive manner, and turning on his heel, slunk down the court. Master Bates followed with a thoughtful countenance. The noise of footsteps and creaking stairs, a few minutes after the occurrence of this conversation, roused the merry old gentleman as he sat over the fire with a saveloy and a small loaf in his hand, a pocket knife in his right, and a pewter pot on the trivet. There was a rascally smile on his white face as he turned round, and looking sharply out from under his thick red eyebrows, bent his ear towards the door and listened. "Why, how's this?" muttered the Jew, changing countenance. "Only two of them? Where's the third? They can't have got into trouble. Hark!" The footsteps approached nearer. They reached the landing, the door was slowly opened, and the Dodger and Charlie Bates entered, closing it behind them.